Hello. Welcome to Profiles. I'm Annie Corrigan, and today we're delighted to welcome into the WFIU studios Alan Pearson, Artistic Director of the group Alarm Will Sound, Principal Conductor of the Dublin-based Crash Ensemble. He's a composer, he's a pianist, he's an occasional physicist, basically just an innovative musician extraordinaire, Alan Pearson. He's visiting us in Bloomington to present two concerts with the IU New Music Ensemble. Alan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Annie.
So the physics comment, that's from your time at MIT in the mid-90s. And, you know, MIT is not necessarily known for its music school.
Well, there is no music school at MIT. It's a music program. They have a music department. It actually took me a while to get used to when I first went to Eastman that composers and theorists and performers were all in different departments, because at MIT it's all... we're all one big family. One not that big family. But actually, MIT was a really great place to do music. There are just a lot of really smart people there. And I think because I wasn't really wasn't gearing myself to being a professional musician when I was there, a lot of my skills I probably developed later on, but a lot of my attitudes about music were developed there. It's a place where I think in part because there's so much talent, but so few people who are actually planning to make lives in music, that there's just a tremendous amount of excitement and energy. People do music because they love it, and, you know, for all the right reasons. And so it's just, it's a really a great place to do music.
So you went thinking that you would study physics and do that with your life?
Yeah. I mean, when I went in as a freshman, I really was very, very broad in what I was thinking about. I was interested in physics, and I was interested in writing, literature. I was interested in being a novelist at one point, and interested in music, math. I didn't really know exactly what I was going to do. I think physics was probably my best guess. And then freshman year at MIT, there's no major. You just take classes. And then so at the end of my freshman year, I declared a physics major.
And what's your instrument? I guess you've started on studying physics, and then you've eventually got to music. What's your instrument?
Piano. But I mean, I was always playing. I was a pretty diverse kid. Growing up, I was interested in enough things in a serious enough way that I think, you know, like my piano teacher assumed I was going to be a professional musician, and my science teacher presumed I'd be a scientist. My math teacher thought I'd be a mathematician. I mean, everyone just sort of thought that, oh, well, that seems to be what he's most interested in. But it was actually, I was pretty spread. But I was playing piano from the time I was about six, and composing from about the same time.
Age six, composing at age six.
Yes, my first song was I Love Rice and Corned Beef. I can still sing it, but I'm not going to right now.
If only we had a recording of that.
If only we did.
If only. Well, then from MIT, you went to Eastman to study composition, to develop the skills that you started when you were 6 years old. Do you still compose today, or is it...
No, Eastman cured me of my of my compositional habit. It was the first time I was really in a serious compositional environment. I'd been composing, you know, basically my whole life, but never in such a rigorous way where, you know, the expectation was that you would have, you know, a new 40 bars of music every week to bring to your lesson. And it was a hard time for me because on one hand, I was being expected to compose in a more, you know, consistent professional way than I ever had before. And at the same time, my mind was just being open to all these other kinds of music. As a undergraduate at MIT, you know, I think in part because you're not in a community of a lot of like serious musicians, there was so much music that I didn't know about. I mean, my horizons were pretty limited. I mean, the music I was writing when I was at MIT was sort of warmed over Copland mixed with Hindemith mixed with Stravinsky. It was really in that vein. I remember I had one friend at MIT, Eddie Kohler, who's a brilliant musician and computer scientist now, teaches at, I think, UCLA, who, you know, introduced me to John Adams. Yeah, actually, I have a very vivid memory of Eddie playing me the John Adams Chamber Symphony over at his apartment one day, and Ligeti and all these composers I really didn't know anything about. You know, still, like, I think at MIT, my horizons were pretty limited. And then going to Eastman and suddenly learning all this other music and feeling like my mind was just being open to all these different ways of writing music. So it was a weird time to try to be composing, because on one hand, I felt like I needed to be just sort of figuring out what I was going to do, what I was going to write, because my ideas about how to write music were changing so quickly. And at the same time, I was sort of being pushed to write a lot quickly. And it just wasn't working. And I remember, you know, just sort of awful days, like putting off, you know, I've got to compose something for my lesson, and putting it off. And then staying up, you know, really late the night before, just writing something. And so composition sort of went very quickly in that first year at Eastman from being something that I really enjoyed to something that I really hated. And that was sort of it. I mean, and since then I get ideas for music, but I'm so out of the habit of writing, and conducting is so consuming at this point that I can't really imagine doing it anymore.
Then how did your musical world focus on conducting? Because it started at Eastman.
Right. I mean, I had conducted some at MIT, and even in high school, a tiny little bit. So I'd flirted with conducting. And at Eastman, it was kind of a guilty habit at Eastman. I had conducted my own music a bunch before. And then, you know, I remember talking with a young composer at Eastman, who I think was an undergrad when I was there, like as a first-year grad student, who was working on a woodwind quintet and was complaining that it just was not coming together. And I said, well, you know, and he was saying that he thought he needed a conductor for it. And I said, well, I could come in and do it. And so I came in and conducted that, and, you know, it was helpful. And then just one thing led to another. And before I sort of knew it, I was just doing a lot of conducting, and I was taking conducting classes. Actually, with David Efron, who's, of course, here now.
Really?
Yeah. So that was some of my first conducting lessons were with David Efron. Yeah, it started out as this sort of, you know, thing that I did when I knew I really should have been writing music. And there was a real, like, turning point for a long time, even when I was conducting more than I was composing, because I didn't really feel comfortable as a conductor, that I was very insistent on, you know, I was not a conductor, I was a composer who was conducting. It was very important for me to talk about myself that way, even though I had not completed a piece in, you know, a year or a year and a half. And then Brad Lubman, who ran the New Music Ensemble at Eastman, who still does run the New Music Ensemble at Eastman, came to me at the end of my first year at Eastman when I really had no idea what I was doing, because it was already pretty clear to me at that point that composition wasn't really working for me. But also I didn't really see a future as a conductor. And so I really did not know what I was going to do. That was probably the hardest. I think I was about 24, and that was really as lost as I've been. And Brad Lubman came to me, and he was running the New Music Ensemble at Eastman, which is a, you know, exact corollary to the group that I was conducting here. And Brad came to me and said, I'm going to be gone for a little while. I need someone to, you know, be my assistant and run the ensemble while I'm gone. Would you be interested? And it was just like, you know, a sort of light turned on, and suddenly, and he also offered to teach me and sort of take me on as a student. And that was huge. That really opened a door for me that I didn't know was there.
What an opportunity as a young 24-year-old first-year master's student to direct the Eastman New Music Ensemble. That must have spurred you on to conducting immediately.
Yeah, and it was really, I remember at the time being really intimidated by it. You know, those first couple rehearsals with Eastman New Music Ensemble were pretty stressful for me.
I bet. Then from Eastman, where did you go from there? If you decided to become a conductor, you had a group that you formed at Eastman.
Well, the group at Eastman was called OSEA, and it actually still exists, and I have nothing to do with it anymore. It started because Gavin Chuck, who was a composer and music theorist at Eastman, came to me and a couple of others with this idea. The initial impetus for OSEA was sort of as a way to address the kind of problem that, you know, composers at schools, music schools, always deal with, which is, you know, how you have a vision, you've written a big piece, how do you put it together? And, you know, the sort of awful experience of, you know, begging 200 violinists to, you know, fill your six seats. And so the idea was to sort of bring together a group of people who would, you know, share in the work of putting together a program, basically, you know, pool efforts. And so Gavin came up with this idea for like a 3-concert series, which would feature mostly Eastman School composers. And then also we were planning a Steve Reich program. And so Gavin asked me to conduct and brought the idea to the administration, which was then headed by James Underkoffler. And, you know, he loved it. And we started this group, and the idea became that it was both, you know, I mean, originally I think it was a vehicle for these composers to sort of get their music done. But then as we started to think bigger, it became really about more generally musical entrepreneurship and about learning the skills of putting a concert together. And so the idea of the organization is that, and it's, you know, funded by the school, that each year there's a board that runs the OSEA, and anyone from the community is welcome to submit a proposal for something that they'd like to do. And if their proposal is chosen, then they work with the board to realize the project. And so it's seen as like a training vehicle for musical entrepreneurship. How do you put concerts together? How do you make a production happen? So we did OSEA for quite a few years when I was at Eastman, and now it's over 10 years old now and still going. And one of the big triumphs of it was the Steve Reich recording that we did, which, you know, Steve was really supportive of. And we recorded Tehillim in 1999. And, you know, Steve loved it. And, you know, Eastman financed the whole thing. They supported the whole effort. And when we had this recording, you know, it was very clear at that point to those of us who were involved in this that, you know, even though OSEA was sort of an amorphous organization in terms of who would play, that there were a bunch of people who'd been playing together in OSEA a lot and had learned how to work together and had a really nice vibe and had this great recording that, you know, could sort of be our calling card. And we were all graduating. And at first, you know, we all were sort of faced with this question that, you know, most music school graduates are of, you know, well, what are we doing next? And, you know, sort of getting ready to say goodbye. And none of us wanted to give up our connection to this group of people. And so we started talking about what to do with that. And then what we eventually ended up doing was creating out of that this new group, Alarm Will Sound. And retroactively, in a way that, you know, not entirely honest, put that name along with OSEA's on the recording. OSEA being a sort of stable organization that none of us are any longer a part of, whereas Alarm Will Sound is a separate organization that has the same people, many of the same people who are on that recording and still work together today. And so we kept that going.
Well, and this is a good place to talk about our first musical selection, which is performed by Alarm Will Sound, your group. Tell us a little bit about this before we hear it.
This was the third recording that we put out. And it is, I think it's our most individual recording so far. The other recordings are music by Steve Reich, music by Michael Gordon. And this CD is music by Aphex Twin. And it was really, the idea was not mine. It was a couple of the players in the group who came up with this idea of taking electronica and arranging it for the ensemble. And, you know, as soon as the idea came up, we all really loved it. You know, it's music that is incredibly interesting, that has the kind of complexity and sort of sonic imagination that speaks to the listeners who love the other music we do, and yet it's from a completely different world and a completely different market. And so the idea of taking this music and figuring out, because it's also music that, of course, is not meant to be played by people at all. I mean, it's all music that's made on a computer. And figuring out how to play it live, how to make it work on instruments. Well, it was an incredibly, like, inspiring creative challenge. It ended up being a really great project. And so this is a CD we put out a couple of years ago called Acoustica, Music of Aphex Twin. And we chose Aphex Twin as someone we thought had sort of the richest output of all the electronic artists that we looked at. And so we decided to do a whole CD of arranging. And so we'll play one of those tracks.
Music performed by the group Alarm Will Sound. directed by Alan Pearson, music of Aphex Twin.
And the piece was Cock for a Ten from Aphex Twin's Drux album.
And before we get too in-depth with the group Alarm Will Sound, you said with the group Osea in Eastman, you performed Te Halim when you were a student, and you brought Te Halim here to IU in October 2007 to perform with students. And I know just from talking to a bunch of people performing in the concert how big a deal that was for us to perform that piece. It's fitting that you bring that piece from your student career to IU for our student careers.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, it's actually even more deeply in my student career than that. I did Te Halim the first time when I was a sophomore at MIT. I conducted a performance of it. So it's a piece that I, you know, had sort of been, it was something I returned to a couple of times in my student career. And it's very interesting doing it, you know, having done it last at Eastman with students there when I was a student there in 99, and then coming here and doing it with students here. You know, it's a very different vibe when, and it was when the performance at Eastman in 99 was really amazing. And I mean, the performance here was really great too. But it's interesting, it's a very different vibe when it's an all-student endeavor, you know. And it was something I was aware of at the time that, you know, I was working with Brad Lubman, who was my teacher in the New Music Ensemble, who's an amazing conductor and, you know, did really great things with the new Music Ensemble at Eastman, the official New Music Ensemble. And yet there were things that we were able to do, you know, as this kind of, you know, grassroots student-run organization that were bigger and more exciting, because people, you know, there's something about when it's not curricular, people are doing it for fun. If you get the right sort of energy for that, it's unlike anything else. And, you know, and we were all very inexperienced at that point. And, you know, the players, you know, even the ones who I work with now were, you know, not as, you know, we were students. So of course the playing was not as strong. And but just the commitment and the amount of time that everybody poured into the project, you know, made it a really special experience. And I mean, everybody was really committed that it be great. And I think everyone was here too, but it is a very different vibe when it becomes, you know, an official, you know, faculty run curricular activity.
Yeah, you're right. And Te Halim was recorded by Alarm Will Sound on one of the four recordings that you've released with that group. So Alarm Will Sound, it's a 20-member band. It's described as a band. I love that.
Right.
That it's a band. And your focus is adding theater to music, and you do these evening-length performances. Tell us a little bit about the group's mission.
Well, I wouldn't say that that the focus is adding theater. I think the focus of the group is putting on performances that have as creating events. I would say the focus of the group is creating, you know, musical events, and the idea being to, you know, bring music and ideas together in a compelling, you know, theatrical way, which doesn't necessarily have to involve always people moving around on stage, but sometimes does. And it's also, it's part of the vision of the group is that it really is a group about the people. And that's part of why I think we talk about it as a band, that it isn't just, you know, usually in a music group is really more about the composers than about the ensemble. And the idea here, the idea of Alarm Will Sound is to really make it about these people. And I think a lot of what makes the group work is that the people are just so interesting. And, you know, they're great players, but then they also just, these people know so much about music and they're such diverse listeners. I mean, the fact that, you know, this Aphex Twin idea came from the group says a lot about the kind of people who are in it. And they're composers and, you know, they arrange and they play all sorts of wild instruments. So, you know, the idea of Alarm Will Sound is to really make it about them.
And you were saying that Stefan Freund, one of the six composers in this group, he arranged these Aphex Twin pieces. And he wrote a piece, too, in the same vein as Electronica.
Right. Right. And, I mean, everybody, we've actually done music by everybody. In all the composers in the group have at some point written a piece for the ensemble that we've played. So that's an important part of what we do. I think the idea of making it a group about the group is that, you know, what makes like the current musical climate for me seem so alive is that there's such a spirit of eclecticism. There's so much different music going on, and there's in a way that I think there wasn't before, a spirit of openness and connectedness and, you know, an awareness that there are connections between post-rock and minimalism and, you know, the avant-garde and the art music world, and that all these things speak to each other. And so the fact that we have people who are really aware, really broadly aware of all these different trends, that's something that we can bring to what we do together.
And you're talking about new music as a sort of umbrella term, but you're right, there are all these little elements to it. And looking at this February concert that Alarm Will Sound did in Carnegie Hall, you're doing more than just new music and electronica. There's a piece on this program, Alan, by Josquin. Talk to me a little bit about that. How do you program Josquin with Ligeti and Aphex Twin?
Right. Well, you know, we are basically a new music group, which in part is the nature of the instrumentation. I mean, the earliest piece really written for this instrumentation is the Schoenberg Chamber Symphony that we did here at IU. Before that, there's Wagner wrote one little piece for this instrumentation. But, you know, you're sort of the instrumentation, this one and a part orchestra, pretty much keeps you in the new music world. I mean, that is our identity. The concept for that concert is arrhythmia. And it's also a CD that we're putting out relatively soon. And the idea of the program was to take music, all of which had, each piece had at its core some kind of regular pulse, some kind of groove, something that was very basic. But then the music took that and twisted it or fragmented it, did something with that groove so that it was still there, but it was somehow off-kilter or not what you expected or layered. And so all these pieces are pieces which do that in different ways. And the two early music pieces we did, the Josquin and the Chaconia piece, both related to Nan Caro, who was one of the core figures of this program. And Nan Caro made his career taking very simple musical ideas, mostly out of jazz, Spanish music, really like vernacular music guide musical ideas that were very basic, but then layering them in these bizarre ways so that you would have, you know, a simple like blues tune going at three different speeds at the same time. So that was sort of Nan Caro's thing. And then with him as kind of a jumping off point, we brought in these other two composers who were much earlier, you know, 500 or so years earlier, Chaconia and Josquin, who did the same thing, actually, far much longer ago. Both of those two pieces are three-part canons in which the three parts all move in different tempos.
This is in reference to the Carnegie Hall concert by Alarm Will Sound. In addition to Alarm Will Sound, you've got the Crash Ensemble, and you've conducted the London Sinfonietta, the New World Sinfonia Training Orchestra. You've had connections with Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble. So you're really starting to be a conductor on the larger classical music stage, not just with Alarm Will Sound.
You know, like it really, I think it all does sort of go back to that Tehillim recording that we did at Eastman in 99. You know, when that got out, it both put Alarm Will Sound on the map and Osea on the map and put me on the map. And we all really rode that. And out of that, I mean, that recording started turning into, you know, offers to come conduct other places. I mean, it's really an amazing thing. I don't know where my life would be now if it weren't for that recording. I don't think there was one single more important event in my career, all of our careers. So that's, you know, that started to lead to other things. I mean, Steve Reich, you know, it got Steve Reich to, you know, talk about me to MTT, which led to that thing at New World Symphony. And then through that, I met the director of the Crash Ensemble, who's Donica Dennehy, who's a composer, an Irish composer. And that led to my being brought over there. And then, you know, also the Steve Reich connection, of course, brought me to the London Sinfonietta. So everything sort of started from there and now has gone off on its own in a way that, you know, it's easy to forget that that's where it started for Alarm Will Sound and me. And
do you always conduct new music with these groups? Have you ever conducted Beethoven, Mozart symphonies?
Yeah, I have. I want to do more of that repertoire.
Really?
I miss doing that repertoire. Mm-hmm. But I don't get to do it as much as I would like. Whenever I work with college orchestras, which I've done a couple of times, you know, I do a lot of that repertoire. But it doesn't, you know, I don't get to do it as much as I would
like. You're the new music guy du jour.
Right. Right.
Well, you mentioned the Crash Ensemble. Let's play another musical selection that you have from that group. Tell us about this.
This is a really amazing piece. Donica Dennehy, who's the director of the Crash Ensemble, wrote this piece for the Crash Ensemble and for Irla O'Leonard, who is a quite well-known Irish singer who sings in a traditional style called Seán Nós, which is a sort of improvised, an old improvised sort of style of storytelling through song. This piece is based on a traditional Shano song, but treats it in a really original way. And you'll hear the, Irla's voice always on top. And then, but the instrumental parts combine a sort of, a kind of rhythmic drive that comes out of very much out of American music, Reich, Michael Gordon, David Lang, that sort of world of American music, along with this very rich kind of European, it's a approach that's called spectral music, where they're all with different harmonics and just a very rich kind of color, sonic color, which is very different from what one usually hears in the music of Reich or Michael Gordon or David Lang. And so it's just a wonderful conglomeration of different kinds of stylistic thinking. And just a really terrific piece of music. I mean, we only have time for an excerpt right here. It's an amazing piece, and it's, you know, 30 minutes long in one big arc, one interrupted movement.
So this is a selection of a fairly substantial work. This work is about a half hour long. We're just going to hear a little bit of it. Music performed by the Crash Ensemble, conducted by our guest today, Alan Pearson. I'm Annie Corrigan. Alan, I'm too curious about your thoughts about the way new music is going. You've started to integrate popular genres with the Aphex Twin, and now you're reimagining Josquin with this Carnegie Hall performance, February of 2008. Tell us a little bit about how you choose what you're going to program on these concerts in terms of, do you develop new composers, traditional works, reimaginings?
Yeah, you know, in a way, like putting a program together is a lot like composing a piece. It's the closest thing that I do now to composing a piece, in that, you know, you really do start with a blank canvas. And the idea is just to create a great experience for the audience. And that's always what I start with is, you know, what are we going to put together to create a great experience? And, you know, usually there's some germ of an idea there. Probably the best way I can answer that question is to take you inside the most recent project that Alarm Will Sound has been working on, which is a plan for a music theater event called 1969 that we've been working on. And the genesis of this was this idea that I had a couple of years ago. I think I was looking at, I forgot even where this began, but I was trying to, I was trying to put together an orchestra program for something completely different. And I got really into the idea of taking a single year and finding a year where there was an interesting mix of historical events, but most importantly of music, because you can find these years where, you know, there are different kinds of music happening at the same time that you don't necessarily realize were happening at the same time. Like the fact that Strauss was writing at the same time as Messiaen in like the mid-1940s. It's amazing. I mean, I think of Strauss as almost a 19th century composer, mm-hmm. Or just, you know, such a different world than, you know, Messiaen or Elliot Carter. And the fact that all this stuff, or Boulez, and the fact that all that was happening at the same time in the mid-40s, it's just really evocative. And so we started with this idea of picking a year and doing a whole concert of music in that year, and somehow using that to also get at some of the history, some of what was happening in the world at that time. And then as we were looking at this, and, you know, looking at different years that we might talk about or might use for programs, 1969 jumped out as this particularly interesting one, both because of all this incredible music that was happening. It was a real, like, time of ferment, musically, I mean, politically, obviously, also, but so many of the people who have now become kind of leaders of the field or major figures of the canon at that time were, you know, real sort of, you know, outside artists almost, you know, real grassroots figures, Steve Reich, Philip Glass, Meredith Monk, Laurie Anderson. I mean, all these people were, you know, these like basically young kids doing crazy off the wall things, totally outside of the mainstream of concert music, you know, and getting these like ridiculous reviews where people were just, you know, had no idea what to say about this music or even didn't know if it really was music. So the fact that all this was happening at the same time that Stravinsky was writing his last pieces, Shostakovich was writing his last pieces, Ligeti was doing some amazing work. And, you know, and then, of course, also, I mean, all, you know, the Beatles and Woodstock and Altamont. I mean, just so much was happening just musically. And then also, of course, you know, socially, politically, with Nixon's election and Cambodia and Vietnam and still the aftershocks of the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King the year before. There just seems so much to look at here. And then one particular event caught all of our attention, which was just a line that I read in a book about Stockhausen, who's a German composer who died just a few months ago. Stockhausen apparently was planning a meeting with the Beatles in New York to plan a joint Stockhausen Beatles concert.
Really?
It was apparently supposed to take place at Lucas Foss's apartment in Manhattan. And the meeting, according to this one source, the meeting didn't happen because of the blizzard that struck Manhattan that year.
Oh, no.
And apparently Stockhausen made it to Lucas Foss's apartment for the meeting, but no one from the Beatles ever showed up. And that idea really struck a chord with us, both for many reasons. I think, for one, because this time, you know, as I mentioned earlier, part of, I think, what Alarm Will Sound is about is a kind of broad horizon of music that we live in today, where we can look at all the different music happening in the world as being sort of connected and as being fodder for whatever we want to put on stage. But that wasn't the case then. I mean, in the 60s, it was still a very divided musical landscape where, you know, either you were in the Stockhausen crowd or you were in the John Cage crowd or you were off in the Steve Reich crowd doing, you know, then the Philip Glass crowd doing this crazy stuff they were doing. But you were in a crowd and you were doing that thing. And so this is the beginning of that kind of opening up. And so the fact that there was this meeting plan between Stockhausen and the Beatles, Stockhausen being this major figure of the avant-garde European music scene, and of course the Beatles being at the time especially the pinnacle of, you know, commercial music, but, you know, creative, imaginative commercial music, and the fact that they had planned to get together, that was a very powerful idea, and an idea that seemed to speak to what Alarm Will Sound is doing now. And the fact that it didn't happen also was a very powerful idea, and spoke, it seemed to us to resonate with the kind of disappointment of all of the call for revolution of the time. I mean, so much of the sort of the revolutionary spirit and, you know, all of the anger and protest and determination to change the system, which really didn't accomplish what it was imagined to do. And so the fact that this meeting didn't happen seemed to be a very powerful and speak to lots of bigger issues. And so we've started planning this concert. And this, you know, as it's developed, it's turned into something very different from a conventional concert in that what we're imagining is a, you know, an event that will combine speaking and lots of different kinds of music, sometimes played as complete pieces, sometimes played just as excerpts, sort of put together in a kind of collage where you're hearing, you know, words by these composers, music, recordings of people speaking, all in a way which, you know, hopefully tells the story and brings the time alive in a way which, you know, makes for an interesting, provocative evening of musical entertainment.
Oh, give us a little hint. What's on this program?
Well, we just did our first workshop of it, which at this point doesn't really have the whole theatrical component. So it's just music. And it, you know, I'm sure it will evolve. But what we did in this workshop included excerpts from Leonard Bernstein's Mass, which was itself, I mean, intended as a really revolutionary piece. Some Berio arrangements of Beatles songs that he wrote for his wife, Kathy Berbarian, as well as Berio's O King, which is written in memoriam Martin Luther King. The real triumph of the first outing with this is an arrangement that our horn player, Matt Marks, did of the Beatles' Revolution 9, sort of in the spirit of what we had done earlier with Aphex Twin. This was a tape piece that the Beatles wrote, at the end of their White Album. And still, you know, it's either, it's the kind of piece that either I find people either don't know it or are totally obsessed with it. It's kind of a one or the other thing. And, you know, it's this incredibly landmark work in that it is very much a piece in the spirit of what people like Stockhausen and Berio were doing with tape and with electronics then, but on a Beatles album. And so it's a really wild piece. And Matt did an amazing job of taking it and finding ways for us, you know, again, without electronics, just with, you know, our instruments and our voices and whatever else we have at our disposal, to recreate it live.
It's a new way of thinking of the three Bs, is all I can think. It's not Beethoven, Bach, and Brahms. We've got Bernstein, Berry on the Beatles.
Yeah, that's right.
That's so funny.
That's right.
Alarm will sound, just doing some innovative things these days. Alan, before you leave us, let's talk a little bit about the stigma surrounding new music. A lot of music lovers out there just feel like it's not for them, and they create this world, this umbrella term of new music, anything written after a certain date, and it's just not for them. Talk to us a little bit about how you would address that.
That's part of why with Alarm Will Sound, you know, I really focus on creating, always, you know, creating productions that will give a listener a great experience. And, you know, I'm sure there's, you know, I'm sure there are people who don't like some pieces that we do. Of course, there always are. But I mean, I feel like we've had a lot of success in terms of bringing in people who haven't had a lot of experience with new music and having them come away like really excited by the experience and really excited to hear more of that, of the music that we played. I mean, the stigma of new music, I mean, there are a lot of different ways to think about what that's about. I think one of them certainly has to do with the lack of filtering time. You know, with older music, we've had 200 years to get rid of all of the not-so-great music that was written around Beethoven's time. We don't have that. We haven't had that luxury with music being written now yet. And so, you know, inevitably, a new music concert is more, just statistically, is more likely to have not-so-great music on it. You know, especially when you're doing, you know, premieres, pieces by younger composers. I mean, just, you know, statistically, there's more of a chance that, there's less a chance that, that it's all going to be really great music. And then also, I think, you know, performers with new music, often because, you know, the music is very difficult and it's very unfamiliar, you know, performances are often less committed and less sort of nuanced than with older music. You know, you can get away with things in a performance of a new piece that you can't get away with in a performance of, you know, a Beethoven symphony. So performances are often of a lower quality. You know, and then the sort of elephant in the room, I guess, is that, you know, there is a real history of very dissonant music, which many people find hard to listen to. And Alarm Will Sound does play some dissonant music. But, you know, I think when we do it, it's always been really successful. And we did a piece by Bert Whistle on this last concert, which was, you know, which is really dissonant, but which is, you know, incredibly energetic and was played with a great deal of commitment. And, you know, I think spoke to people who maybe weren't familiar with that kind of vocabulary. So I guess my answer to that question is that I feel like when, you know, when the music is carefully chosen, when you're doing music that is really good and you're performing it really well and presenting it in, you know, in a well thought out, provocative, engaging context, that, you know, it speaks to people.
Alan, one final question before we leave. You're still fairly young. You have so much more of your musical career ahead of you. So imagine yourself in 10 years. Where do you see yourself in 10 years as a musician conductor?
I'd like to be better. You know, basically, I'm doing what I want to do now. You know, I would just like to tweak it more. I'm already sort of basically conducting as much as I can, so I don't feel like I need a busier schedule. I feel incredibly lucky right now to be able to be, you know, a working musician who gets to go around the world and play with all these different groups and, you know, have so many different experiences with so many great players. So I would like to just continue to do that. If I could tweak that a little bit, I'd like to get to do more earlier music. I like to have a more diverse repertoire of what I'm getting to conduct. I miss doing earlier music a great deal. And I'd like to work with more larger groups rather than just smaller groups. You know, having come from MIT and grown up with many, many interests, you know, I came to a focus on conducting pretty late. I mean, I was definitely in my mid to late 20s before I started calling myself a conductor. And so, you know, I really just, you know, I see myself in the next 10 years just keep working at it and keep getting better and keep hopefully keep getting to do it and being happy doing it and working with lots of more great people.
And hopefully coming back to Bloomington. One more piece that you brought us. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, this is a recording that just came out that I did with the London Sinfonietta. And in a way, this sort of, you know, bookends the story we've been telling, because my work in conducting really began with the recording of Steve Reich that I did at Eastman with OSEA and Alarm Will Sound in a very, you know, ad hoc, grassroots sort of student organized sort of way. And this is the exact opposite. This is a recording I just did with the London Sinfonietta, which is an amazing group of players. I mean, the scene in London, the level of playing there is amazing. I think because the players have to work so hard, many of them play in many different groups in a way they don't here in America. And so the level of sight reading is sort of astounding. So this is a completely different situation when, you know, compared to, you know, the first Reich recording that I did with OSEA at Eastman, you know, we rehearsed for months and months and months and, you know, endless hours. This was a situation, a totally very professional situation. The players came in, were handed their music, and that's it. We're in the studio. We have 6 hours to record this piece.
Wow.
So, you know, completely different type of situation. And but, you know, again, this is also music by Steve Reich, a new piece that he wrote, which we did the world premiere recording of.
Music of Steve Reich will take us out for this edition of Profiles. Variations for vibes, pianos, and strings. Just a movement of this larger work. Performance by the group, the London Sinfonietta, directed by our guest, Alan Pearson. Thank you so much for visiting with me and the WFIU audience. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is Annie Corrigan for Profiles. Thank you for listening.
The program you have just heard was recorded in April of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.